Major funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Sexuality and Subcultures, this week on Soundings. My guest is Jonathan Dollimore of the University of Sussex. Jonathan Dollimore is the author of Radical Tragedy, Religion, Ideology, and Power in the Drama of Shakespeare and His Contemporaries. He's co-editor of Political Shakespeare, New Essays in Cultural Materialism. During his recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Jonathan Dollimore worked on a study entitled Sexuality, Transgression, and Subcultures. Here is Jonathan Dollimore.
To put it very simply, to understand the history of homosexuality is to understand the history of heterosexuality, which means that one is understanding there one of the crucial organizing principles of our world. Heterosexuality, its relationship to the family, the differential status of men and women within heterosexuality, this and a whole range of other issues which, as it were, reach right out into the entire social organization. These are implicitly necessary questions when one is looking at the history of minorities, because the minority is always strangely, violently bound up with the majority. Now, I just want to add a qualification there. I am not saying that the only reason to study homosexuality is to look at heterosexuality. There is another crucially important aspect to my work and that of other people in this area. We want to recover the history of cultures, and there's not just one gay culture, there are many gay cultures. We want to recover the histories of those cultures because they have, as it were, been silenced, marginalized, occluded, brutally suppressed in some cases. And it's only relatively recently that that history is being written.
Right. Do you think of these efforts, Jonathan Dollimore, as proselytic? Or are you evangelizing the cause of homosexuality? Are you describing its place in history? That, I think, may account for a lot of the fear and personal, social, cultural response a gay individual comes across as trying to make converts. Is that part of the agenda here?
I think that there is a great deal of fear. And again, I would want to turn the question back around on its own assumptions. Why is there the fear? Now, for example, if one was talking to a Christian who is also an historian, one would know that a certain kind of history was being written, but one wouldn't be absolutely terrified at the notion that that individual historian would have a particular investment. Yeah. Or take the example of feminism. We can accept, I think, that some of the very best history recently has been written by people who are trying to combine the commitment of feminism with the responsibility of the historian.
Well, the difference may be that in the former two instances here, Christianity and feminism, you don't have that strong sexual threat to what to one's notion of one's sexual self.
Well, I would disagree with that. I would say that, in fact, that is precisely how feminism has been perceived and is perceived
as a sexual threat.
But one of the reasons why it has been so effective in challenging that prejudice is because its history has been so good. Uh-huh. And my point is this: that there is no reason why a gay historian should not be in exactly that same position of producing, though from a particular point of involvement, a history which is important to people who are themselves not personally identified. I mean, that's absolutely crucial. It has been done. It is being done. Mm-hmm. And I make the analogy with the feminist and the Christian to show that there may be a tension there. Of course there may, for any of us. But whereas people would want to say that somehow a gay person could also not be a good historian because he is so biased,
right,
I'd ask you to think about the analogies and to realize that that is simply false.
You told me before our taping session, Jonathan Dollimore, that the name Sigmund Freud is important in an understanding of the history of homosexuality. Freud, set up some of the basic ground rules that we've inherited from the 19th century. I mean, he was harking back, of course, farther than that in his articulation of them. With regard particularly to a term
Well, the word is repression.
Yeah.
And as we repress, we misinterpret. Talk to me for a few minutes about that.
Let me come to that via a novel. A novel by Manuel Puig called, in translation, The Kiss of the Spider Woman. In fact, it was made into a film.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the novel is very different from the film, and it's a wonderful novel. And it's about two men in a prison, a Marxist revolutionary and another man who is gay. I mean, these people initially seem to have absolutely nothing in common. Indeed, they have every apparent difference. Now, what happens is that they fall in love. They have a relationship. And what the author does is to, as a relationship develops, he adds a whole series of footnotes, which are simply quotations from all the competing explanations in Western culture on homosexuality.
You mean to account for this relationship?
Well, I think the point is that it's to contrast the extraordinarily wonderful simplicity of the narrative. He makes the affair so ordinary that it is profound in terms of its very ordinariness. And what one senses over and over again is precisely, of course, that there's a sense in which this does not need to be explained. And what one gets is this mounting incongruity between these footnotes from Freud, from other historians, sexologists, and so on, which sometimes become so extensive that the footnote entirely displaces the main text, except for one or two lines.
Should I accuse you, Jonathan Dollimore, of trivializing the history of homosexuality to talk about a single novel, which happened to be made into an American movie that happened to have some credence and popularity?
No, because my point is this, that there is a sense in which doing this history, one should not slip into the assumption of everybody else, Freud, etc., that homosexuality needs explaining. Hmm. Or rather, if it does need explaining, that is only exactly in the sense that heterosexuality needs explaining. Now, I wanted to put in that context because that is a crucial proviso. And having said that, we can then come back to Freud, one of the great theorizers of homosexuality. And of course, what he argued was that when a child is born, the child is polymorphous perverse. It is heterosexual, it is homosexual, it's everything. And Freud argues that civilization necessarily requires the repression of the homosexual component. And for that child to grow up into the appropriate adult, positioned within sexual difference, that repression has to take place. But it's never got rid of. It goes down into the unconscious and always erupts in ways which disturb and displace the individual and indeed society.
Well, let me propose to you, Jonathan Dollimore, that we live in an ideal world of toleration, or at least we want to pursue that goal. How do we combat the prejudice that you find inherent in our politics, in our culture? How is it that you are going to convince people who find homosexuality abhorrent to take it seriously, to accept it as part of the culture, and not feel destroyed or threatened?
Once again, to turn the experience round on the person who's having it and ask why they have the abhorrence. Mm-hmm. And one way in which to counter the prejudice would be to say to that individual, and this would be following the Freudian line, that he or she is in fact repressing their own homosexuality. The argument would be that their anger, their hatred, their horror, mm-hmm, of the homosexual, in other words, their homophobia, it's itself related to their own repressed desires. Now, that's one way. Now, that may or may not be true in individual cases. There's another, perhaps far more important line of inquiry. And this is something which is associated with modern sexology, Marxist subcultural theory, and in particular by a very famous philosopher, Michel Foucault. Mm-hmm. And Foucault would argue that, in fact, homophobia, the hatred of homosexuality, is something which is actually more to do with heterosexual culture. In other words, the idea is that the homosexual is a category, an identity, which is produced. And let us remember that the word homosexual was invented only in 1869. It's extraordinary to think that it's only been around for just over 100 years.
What did the Greeks call it?
Well, let me just follow that through. From Foucault, because the point is here that he would say that this demonized category is constructed. And the reason why it's constructed is, in a sense, to police heterosexuality. You have the demon over there, and precisely in, as it were, consciously, I'm trivializing this a little bit, in consciously daily being not like that, you in fact position yourself voluntarily in the conformist, accepted, necessary roles of society.
Well, this is a generalization on the on what do you want to call it, criminal theory, that we call certain people criminal in order to define our own rectitude.
That's right.
But doesn't the analogy break down, Jonathan Dollimore, when we say, all right, people who are bank robbers or who are rapists or who are arsonists are taking the law, doing something that the majority will not tolerate. Doesn't the analogy break down when we talk about very personal sexual behavior that is not consistent with majority behavior?
I think that you have to ask the question about whose interests are being served in the process of demonizing and control. Now, the point that I would make in relation to the position of the homosexual in history, is that if you look at that process of demonizing, and of course it's a very violent history, we're talking about a history where people over and over and over again have been murdered, brutally beaten, sometimes mutilated. So we're talking about a very violent history and something which I think all of us need to know more about. But if you ask, well, why does that occur? Then I think you can begin without ever offering a complete explanation of that violence, because there always seems to be something so excessive about it, which is almost beyond the realm of any functionalist account. But one can see that certain power structures are being held in place by that violence. Now, that's clearly quite a different issue from looking at another mode of demonizing, which is a form of violence against the individual by someone else within an extremely powerful position. So let's hold at bay some of the big, heavy moral judgments and start to take apart the history and the concepts. Ask whose interests are really being served with these categories, with these identities.
Well, it is people in power. And my inclination is to say to you, so what? What is it that, let's put it this way, how do we overcome the fear? How do we increase the tolerance?
I think that's an issue which can go one of two ways. There's a great, in cultural theory today, we are always talking about the fear of the other.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a very civilized political philosophy which would say, look, we have got to come to terms with the fact that there are different cultures, there are different ways of living, and we've got to accept that. I think that's extremely valuable, that move. But homosexuality throws that into some confusion, because the extraordinary thing about homosexuality, that what disturbs people, so distresses people, is that it is a relationship between two people who are the same. Now, why should relationship between sameness be so abhorrent? And by implication, the relationship between difference be the norm. So what I'm suggesting to you, that if people do indeed fear the other, there's also a sense in which they fear the same. And I suspect that if we want to understand all of those violent forms of discrimination within a culture, as opposed to between cultures or between nations, then we might just ask questions around this fear of sameness.
You are suggesting that we investigate ourselves, that we look at the fragments inside of our social, personal, sexual, psychological makeups and come to terms with them.
No, well, yeah, that would be, again, the Freudian line. Well, I think that is important. I think it has very, very serious limitations. We've not got to introspect to find our deep, as it were, personal fears. Or rather, if we do that, we've got to recognize that those deeply interior subjective fears are absolutely inseparable from the society in which we live. They have been produced within us in terms of our experience within that society.
Jonathan Dollimore, let's change the focus of our discussion here, the history of homosexuality. You are writing a book here at the Humanities Center on the marginal, the deviant, the perverse, the role of what? The sexual other in our cultural conceptions. You're interested in Shakespeare. Was Shakespeare gay?
Great question. Do you
intend to make him gay?
Was Shakespeare gay? Supposing we asked Shakespeare, supposing he was here, or we went back, are you gay? Now, of course, Shakespeare would not understand the question. I mean, literally, the word gay would mean something else entirely.
Absolutely.
Okay, so let's reformulate it. Let's say,
are you a homosexual?
Are you a homosexual? But again, that's no good, because the word was invented in 1869.
Well, what was the language Shakespeare would have used?
That's right. Now, it's not just a question of finding an alternative word to describe the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
What the fact of that absence of language suggests to us, and this has been explored by historians, is that sexuality was conceived of in different terms then. It was structured differently. And if we go back to, say, the sonnets, I mean, the great embarrassing question, are the sonnets
about a man?
Well, that's right. Uh-huh. Are they about homosexuality? Now,
Wait a minute. What happened to the Dark Lady?
But what is it that disturbs commentators? Uh-huh. What is it that commentators have to disavow? It's not the heterosexual relationship. They might well misrepresent the nature of that relationship, and they may well be entirely misogynist in the process, but what really disturbs is the question of the homosexuality. Mm-hmm. Now, again, before you start to say, yes, it is or no, it isn't, we've got to understand what homosexuality or its equivalent might have been. And that turns out to be an extremely confusing thing. And what we learn is either the inadequacy of our present concepts or the fact that they didn't apply in those times. Now, what would count as homosexuality in the sonnets? A relationship between two men? Clearly, no. That's not necessarily homosexual. You see my point? What is really issue here is an extraordinarily sharp divide between the sexual and the non-sexual, probably around genital intercourse. Uh-huh. Now, other cultures do not. Other cultures would probably be amused that we have this terribly anxious, fearful, either it is or it isn't around that specific point. Uh-huh. So again, before we start to categorize Shakespeare in any way, we might actually come up with some very interesting historical statement about the sonnets, but let's ask what that implies about our own procedures of classification.
So we're really not investigating the notion of sexuality in Shakespeare. What we're investigating is our interpretive response to what goes on in Shakespeare.
Yeah, but the two things are inseparable because, mm-hmm. you know, somebody once said about Othello, it may not have been a play about race, but it has become a play about race. And why has it become that? Not only because of the history of Western culture, the racist history of our culture, but because people have endlessly asked that anxious question about
Is it not also a question about sexuality?
Of course, and it would be precisely the adequate study would be one which showed how in that play issues of race and issues of sexuality are inseparable. But if we bring that analogy back to the sonnets, again, I'd say about the sonnets that even if they never were about homosexuality in inverted commas, they have become, mm-hmm. in a sense, about it. Because even if a scholar vehemently denies, strenuously denies that homosexuality has anything to do with those poems, that scholar is still, as it were, keeping homosexuality in focus.
Are you telling me, Jonathan Dollimore, that the issue here is not so much the sexuality, hetero-homosexuality, miscegenated sexuality in Shakespeare? It's not so much those issues as it was the issue of tolerance for sexual issues in Elizabethan society that we don't have today for all of our open-mindedness, for all of our political liberalism?
I think it would be very difficult to defend that period as in any way more tolerant than ours. But what one could say is that because the modes of classification, the ways of identifying people were different, there may have been certain kinds of freedom which were available. For example, Alan Bray, the historian of homosexuality in the Renaissance, has argued on the one hand, the official notion of what the homosexual was. It's just an extraordinarily frightening category. The homosexual was a religious heretic, a papist.
Was a homosexual stigmatized in Shakespeare in any way, Jonathan?
Certainly the homosexual was stigmatized as an identity. But the point is this, that the construction, the notion of what, and we should really be talking about the sodomite, because again, the word didn't exist, but the sodomite was, as it were, someone who was connected with every other conceivable evil in the universe. Hmm. Now, this was very interesting because it meant that ordinary people could not identify with that. And in fact, Bray suggests that homosexuality in the Renaissance, if you're talking about physical sexual relationships between people of the same sex, was really quite widespread. And there simply wasn't the connection made between this demonic, papist heretic, you know, who was undermining the fabric of society and who would, you know, incur God's never-ending wrath if you didn't destroy them, because that was so demonized and so removed from people's experience that the connections weren't made, except in times of crisis. And then very often individuals were scapegoated and, as it were, moved over into those larger categories. And if that happened, then, of course, they were lost.
Jonathan Dollimore, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. I know that you're a literary scholar, a cultural historian. You're not a medical doctor. How is it that you're going to separate in the minds of people who want to be tolerant, who bring to the question of homosexuality a degree of tolerance, or to those who are intolerant? How are you going to separate the argument that you make for our acceptance of the other, the sexually speaking, when we have these terrible, awful, pressing problems around us? We talk about AIDS. We talk about disease. Do we conflate those issues? Do we separate them? How is it that we sort them out so that we understand the proper issues?
I would say that we have to address the question of what is and what is not natural. And I would say of nature that as many crimes have been committed in the name of nature as in the name of God, mm-hmm. and that's going some. We've got to take apart the notion of nature. I'm not talking about getting rid of all values. I'm talking about showing how that concept has been one of the most repressive notions in our culture. Now, in the literature that I look at, the history of gay culture, the way that it combats this utterly erroneous notion that it is unnatural. Mm-hmm. There are two ways. One way is to say, well, actually, we are natural too. Homosexuality is natural. So, for example, André Gide, that was very much his line of inquiry. He would defend his homosexuality passionately as natural as anything. The other way, associated with people like Oscar Wilde, Genet, Joe Orton, is, as it were, to sabotage the very notion of the natural, to, as it were, undermine it from within, to show that it is a concept which is not only repressive of cultural difference, but actually also enormously repressive of those people who think of themselves as natural.
Well, that's a very bold thing to do, but it adds to the sexual threat a political threat, an ideological radicalism that in its own way is intolerant on its own side as the intoleration of, what, the conservatives and the fundamentalists on their side, is it not?
No, because if would you call a parent intolerant who demanded that their children do not starve to death? Mm-hmm. Would you call a parent intolerant if they were defending their children against violence? I wouldn't even call it intolerant if I was defending anyone against violence. But you see the point.
We're back to a tribalism there.
Well, not really, but you're already assuming, you see, that some forms of discrimination are acceptable and others aren't. Uh-huh. And my point would be that you don't have any choice about the connection between homosexuality and politics, partly because, again, it goes right back to the Renaissance. As the sodomite was also the religious heretic, we've had this tradition right through into the 20th century. So if you think about the great spy controversies in relation to the Cambridge spies and so on in Britain.
There's a sexual dimension.
Always there was this sense of, my God, it's bound up with sexual deviance. Yeah. Political heresy and sexual deviance have always been associated in Western culture. Hmm. So in a sense, it's there. Now, what I would also say is I would want to switch that around from being an utterly negative disavowal. I would want to say that we come back around and to insist that any talk of homosexuality, but also of sexuality more generally, is a political question. Because it's to do with power relations. It's to do with the way that we are all organized in society. It's to do with the family. You really can't move in relation to any question of sexuality, which is not also a question about power.
Let's wrap up our conversation, Jonathan Dollimore. We began on a cultural note. We have talked about the political dimension, the ideological dimension to the history of homosexuality. Let's come back to that question I put to you a few moments ago. Was Shakespeare gay? Does it make any difference that he was or was not?
I have no idea. I'm not even interested to find out. I don't think we could find out. I think he wouldn't have understood the question. If you want me to be as constructive as I can, then my answer would be that we would have to understand sexuality as it is represented in his plays, and of course it is. And you know, what I find so interesting about Shakespeare is that what we struggle to accept again, namely the obvious relationship between sexuality and power, was self-evident in the Renaissance. I'm not saying it was better, either an incredibly brutal society in both its the way it exercises its power, and particularly within heterosexuality, in
terms of closer to the surface.
Well, yes, in a way that, I mean, the point is this: that it's not only the case that men brutally dominated women, but they thought it was right to do so, and because they thought it was right to do so, as you say, it's on the surface. So, without in any way condoning those relationships, there's a sense in which we can learn from their visibility. Whereas now, because we have the notions of the authenticity of the sexual, that it's deeply to do with our inner being, you know, we're worried by this notion that, in fact, it's actually in a quite mundane way about power relations. Somehow it seems to contradict a most precious part of ourselves. But they wouldn't have thought that. So we can learn from that.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a conversation with Jonathan Dollimore of the University of Sussex. During his recent fellowship year at the center, Jonathan Dollimore worked on a study entitled Sexuality, Transgression, and Subcultures. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 484. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Rita Dove and Robert Terhorst of the University of Rochester. Our topics will be Rita Dove's sequence of poems, Dürer's Beauty, and a new study by Robert Terhorst of the Gilded Age in American Culture. Here's news of interest to high school teachers. From mid-June through early July of 1990, the National Humanities Center will sponsor two enrichment programs for high school teachers of literature and history. Participants will receive travel, lodging, and a stipend of $750. For an application, write to Summer Institutes, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. This week marks an anniversary for the agreement that officially ended the American Revolutionary War, ratified by the Continental Congress in January 1784. 162 years later, in early January 1946, delegates from 51 nations met in London for the first gathering of the United Nations General Assembly. Jean-Pierre Blanchard made the first manned balloon flight in American history in early January 1793. Among the witnesses was President George Washington. Early January birthdays include the first American president to resign from that office, Richard Nixon, born in January 1913. Wilkie Collins, the English novelist, was born in early January 1824. 55 years ago this week, in early January 1935, Elvis Presley, the king of rock and roll, was born in Tupelo, Mississippi. Early January 1885 saw the birth of Alice Paul, founder of the National Woman's Party. Finally, the American writer Jack London, the colonial governor John Winthrop, and the creator of the Fuller Brush Company have birthdays in early January. Jack London in 1876, John Winthrop in 1588, and Carl Fuller in 1885. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Sexuality, Transgression, and Subcultures. This week on Soundings. Jonathan Dollimore of the University of Sussex discusses homosexuality, politics, and culture in English Renaissance literature. Jonathan Dollimore is the author of Radical Tragedy and Political Shakespeare. How do scholars recover the history of sexuality? Sexuality, Transgression, and Subcultures, this week on Soundings.